It's Tuesday afternoon here on Downtown and time for a message in the bottle. Brought to you by Bangor Wine and Cheese Company at 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor, right between Brahma Grill and Fiddlehead. Eric Meehan joins us in studio. Good day, sir.
Hello. How's everybody doing today?
Wonderful. How's your Tuesday?
Sunnier than yesterday.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yeah, the nor'easter thing, I mean, it's worse when it's snow, but it's still bad when it's rain.
Yeah, that was awful.
Like, if I didn't have the life I have, I'd probably love it. I mean, it'd probably be, like, the perfect time to, like, sit down and read all those dark and stormy night type novels I've accumulated, but alas, no, I do have children, and so I've got to contend with not being able to send them out into the rain.
Mm-hmm.
I did, though. I built them a basketball hoop this weekend, though. That helped.
I saw pictures of that on social media. You built that?
With the help of my good friend Justin. It called for two capable adults, and as he noted, between us, we at least had one. Mm. So, you know, it worked out.
Very impressive.
No serious injuries or anything like that, despite our best efforts. It was cool.
So, let me see your hands, your wrist.
They're all good. This is all legit.
I thought maybe from jamming it, you know.
So, like, you know, it goes from, like, 7 feet to actual regulation height. And, of course, being that it is actually for my children, I set it low.
Yes.
And I went and, you know, took a shot. And my neighbor's just kind of looking at me, shaking his head. Yeah. Like, impressive, Eric. Wow. A whole foot of clearance.
You're 2 or 3 inches off the ground.
I felt like Spud Webb. It was amazing. Yes. Except Spud Webb is, I think, an entire foot shorter than I am.
Right.
And he actually could dunk.
Big old windmill. Yeah. Eric Charles, this is how you do it.
Oh, I'm talking scholarship with those. I mean, we're serious here.
I like that.
I can't afford college. They can. They have their little bodies that are going to grow into big bodies. So we're for a couple more weeks, we're talking about appellations, just to remind everybody. And we talked about champagne, and last week we talked about Burgundy. And today we're going to talk about a slight subset of Burgundy. So just so you all understand that within an appellation, there are other appellations. So basically more important and more specific sites within the grander delimited zone and why those things are important as well. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. Just to refresh you all, appellations are that's a word that we use to define sort of the geographically delimited zone. Very often there are rules that come with that. What kind of grapes you have to plant, how long they have to be aged, how long they have to be held and bottled before you release them. Certain regions have a lot of rules. Certain regions have almost no rules. And because of those varying things, appeal to different kinds of winemakers, people who are kind of iconoclasts and want to do their own thing, then sometimes they go for the no rules. as we talked about, Burgundy has so many rules and is so sort of codified because of the Cistercian monks. So a religious order that set up shop there and kept assiduous records for hundreds of years on, you know, what they were planning, where they were planning it, what the results were. And they really helped sort of define what it is to do a lot of viticultural research. And the later growers took those records and kind of went with them. And so today we have the rules of in Burgundy, which is, as you know, part of France. Pinot Noir has to be the red grape. Chardonnay has to be the white grape. There are a couple asterisks in there, and basically the region runs from basically Dijon on down towards Lyon, if anybody kind of knows where that is, but it's about two-thirds of the way towards Germany and France. It was heavily contested during the wars. There's still a lot of active mines and stuff in that part of the world. It's kind of sketchy, but mostly because of the heavy investment in this area, most everything has been cleared. So what is Chablis or Chablis, right? It's not Chablis, by the way. That's always a joke whenever I say it that way. Chablis is a region. It is technically part of Burgundy, right? So the laws apply. Chardonnay grape, Pinot Noir grape. But Chablis goes a couple steps further. First of all, it's removed from Burgundy by about 60 kilometers. It's about to the northwest, about 60 kilometers. The subsoil, and we talked about this when we were talking about Champagne, and we tried that Champagne style wine from England, the subsoil is this Kimmeridgian ancient sea soil. So you still get that wonderful driven chalky minerality and acidity like you get in Champagnes, like you got in that British Bubbles, like you get in the Sauvignon Blancs of the Sancerre region that we've talked about before. So that's really important. Also, there's no red Chablis. So I said the Pinot Noir would be the grape, and indeed, there are Pinot Noir plantings up in Chablis, and last year, around this time, we tasted one which has its own separate little appellation, can't be called Chablis. Chablis, by law, is white. And there's four ranks of Chablis. There's Petit Chablis, there's regular Chablis, there's Premier Cru and Grand Cru. And basically, the difference between all these is orientation of versus the sun, south-southwest, at what kind of angle. And sometimes there are slightly different ancient subsoil seas. For instance, the Petit Chablis is on what we call Portlandian soil, which is a different ancient seabed. It is very, very old as well, but it is slightly different than the Kimmeridgian soil that makes Champagne and Chablis so famous.
Portlandian soil, is that where the hipsters live?
I know, there's a joke there somewhere. I swear, as soon as I saw that, I'm like, oh my goodness. The other difference is alcohol levels and storage and things like that. Mostly stainless steel tanks are being still used in Chablis to retain that freshness and vitality, though you do see some neutral barrels and some, even some slightly oakier variations on the more valuable stuff. And the wine we're drinking today is kind of cool. So this just made me giggle. So for years and years, I've been, obviously in the wine business for a long time, and you hear, various names, and names become famous. And then you see, very, very clever folks who managed to finagle their way into things. So I was reading about, we're drinking Domaine Guéguen, G-U-E-G-U-E-N, the Celine and Frederick, and very often, for those of you who don't realize, in France, very often it will be the husband and wife team on the label. It is not just the man, not just the wife. Very often, if they are a husband and wife team, they will both be featured predominantly on the label. That's a very, very normal thing. In this case, both of them are indeed winemakers, but how they got together and where this all came from, at first I noticed that Frederick had made wine for about 15 years for a very famous Chablis house called Domaine Brocard. I said, oh, that's cool, that's legit. And then he talks about how a couple of wine growers who are aged and moving towards retirement said, do you want to manage my vines and, make your own label? And so that's how Domaine Guéguen got started. And then I looked up Celine, and Celine is Brocard's daughter. So he obviously went to work for Jean-Marc Brocard and said, boy, she's cute.
Mm.
And that ended up working out really well for him. So if you're ever looking to get into the wine industry, find someone with an available potential spouse, I guess, is the real key.
It's a good plan.
And then you can take over. Actually, for any of you who really want to take over a French wine estate, there's actually literally hundreds of people who would probably be thrilled to sell you their estate. There's an entire generation who are bemoaning the fact that they're retiring and no one wants to go the grunt work life of, getting up at very early hours and uncomfortable hours and dealing with, it's very unpleasant tending vines in the middle of February. I mean, just imagine it's just as cold and nasty there as it is here.
Right.
But that's what Chablis is. So just understand, folks, that when we're talking about Appalachians and talking about Chablis and talking about Burgundy and talking about this, and next week we're actually going to move on to an American wine, a single vineyard American wine, and talk about, again, Appalachians within Appalachians. So these more important spots within generally considered fairly important spots, of course, Burgundy important, Chablis more important, therefore more specified. And then within Chablis, there are single vineyards and little things like that. So it goes bigger to smaller in terms of that. And typically in terms of cost, the smaller you get in terms of parcel size, the greater the cost of the bottle, which kind of makes sense because you can't make all that many bottles out of a very, very small vineyard. And very often the elaboration, the oaking, the whatever takes more money. So that will lead to higher costs in some of those more specific sites. But of course, they are worth it for the varying reasons. I mean, they're not just arbitrarily designated as, we're going to, sell, everything from this little hectare for $80 a bottle. It's because that hectare is special. So, and for more information, come on into your favorite wine merchant. We can talk to you about things like that. Because there's really, really excellent lower level wines that you don't have to spend an arm and a leg for to get an idea of, for instance, the magic of Chablis. And this one is fantastic. This
sure
sells
is.
For low 20s, I think it is, and which is very inexpensive for actual Chablis. But again, this guy has a real gig. This is just fruit that is basically being granted to him as a return for working the vine. So it's really wonderful. So anybody who wants to learn more about this wonderful wine and a lot of other really wonderful terroir-driven wines, do come and see us this Thursday at Bangor Wine and Cheese. We have our tasting. We have a special guest, in fact. His name is Jack Scully. He is the owner of Easterly Wines. Easterly Wines is the company responsible for bringing in Domaine Gauguin Chablis into the state, as well as a couple other really tremendously good wines. The Gus Born bubbles that we had, though I think we're actually going to be trying a different set of bubbles called Gamay Turbulon, which is from the Loire Valley, and it's sparkling, slightly off-dry Gamay, which is the grape in Beaujolais. It's killer. It's awesome. Come in and try that. And also, we have a beer dinner, a Japanese dinner and beer dinner at Novio's June 13th. Don't miss that. Tickets are going fast, as they always do. And then Wine on the Waterfront is coming up June 16th. We are going to be there as a major sponsor as well, so we hope to see you there. So, yeah, go out there, drink stuff, and... hopefully we're in for a nice week, so we have a lot of wonderful hot weather wines.
Yes,
come and get some, and beers and meads and all that stuff, and we look forward to seeing you all in the shop.
I like the sound of that. Thanks, Eric.
Cheers.
Eric Mann, Bangor Wine and Cheese. Message in the Bottle, every Tuesday afternoon on Downtown, brought to you by Bangor Wine and Cheese, 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor, right between Brahma Grill and Fiddlehead.